Welcome to the ESRI and the Science of Wear podcast. In Brisbane, Australia, leaders are using an advanced digital twin to view a huge infrastructure project even while it's being built. It's next level stuff. This started with the city creating its first subway. It's a $4 billion transit project with miles of tunnels running under the Brisbane River and four stations beneath a dense downtown. To plan holistically, Brisbane needed a living digital twin. By modeling data across space and time, they could communicate visually and transparently, getting buy-in from stakeholders along the way. Russell Vine, the project's lead innovation officer, says advanced visualization was the key to eliminating bottlenecks and preparing the city for the 2032 Olympics.
You absolutely need to put in place the things that you need to move people around by public transport, not just rail, but bus. And we have a ferry network that goes up and down our river. For example, you need more bike paths. You need walkable connections. We need river crossings. So there's a whole bunch of stuff to do there. It's really all about priming the system for a more wholesale shift away from the car and onto public transport.
Russell Vine describes to ESRI's John Lenihan the innovations in this massive infrastructure project.
Hi, Russ, and welcome to ESRI and the Science of Wear podcast.
Hey, John. Great to be on. Great to be with you.
All right. So first, can you please tell us what your role is with Cross River Trail?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the General Manager for Communications and Engagement at the Cross River Rail Delivery Authority, but I'm also the project's Lead Innovation Officer.
Doing some research for the discussion, Russ, I've heard you speak of the need to reimagine infrastructure. Why is this so critical to cities?
Yeah, so we've been looking at and breaking down and getting deep into how you might visualize a piece of infrastructure. In our case, a new railway line, we've realized that actually it begs the question, how do people think about infrastructure and when they are planning infrastructure for a city? And Brisbane on the east coast of Australia is almost like the perfect Petri dish sim city. It's a growing metropolis in a beautiful spot down in the corner of the earth on the double bend of a river, but it has some pretty significant public transport constraints. And so what we feel that we've been able to do with the Cross River Rail project is think through not only the public transport fixes that we need right now, but the public transport fixes that will be a catalyst for the future improvements of public transport out over the next 10, 15, 20 years. The cities, basically, they need to build for the problems they've got, but they also need to build for the future they're going to have.
So cities are scrambling to figure out across the world how to modernize or reimagine existing infrastructure to deal with new populations moving into the cities or any other kind of number of considerations. What would you tell them to consider based on your experiences?
Yeah, look, first of all, I'd say get going. When Cross River Rail first went into delivery back in 17, it was agreed this infrastructure project that had been talked about for as much as 10 years prior, and that's pretty common in cities. There's often a lot of talk about mega projects like this. The longer you leave it, the more it's going to cost, the harder it's going to be to build. So get going, do you know what I mean? It's never going to get any cheaper or get any easier for waiting. And the other thing is build the right infrastructure in the right order. Our project is a great example of where if you put this fix, if you unlock this bottleneck at the core of the network, it makes rail extensions and rail upgrades out into the suburbs and at the extremities of the rail network more viable. It's really about don't delay. If you know you need some kind of critical improvement, don't delay. And then in terms of what order you build things in, sensibly start at the middle, make sure you build the infrastructure that's catalytic for investment over 5, 10, 15 years.
That's good advice and can be applied to a lot of things. Get started. So
yes, absolutely.
Brisbane has the Olympics coming in 2032. You have tons of commuters coming to work in Brisbane daily. So you've got public pressure, political pressure. You're building this massive addition to your transit system. What are the most important outcomes you're looking to achieve with the Cross River Rail?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, 2032 is an amazing outcome for Brisbane. The idea that history will dictate that the Olympics were in Tokyo and then Paris and then LA. And then Brisbane is awesome. Okay, do you know what I mean? It's fantastic. It's a real coup for my hometown, and we're really excited by the idea of 32. But that's not the reason we're building Cross River Rail. We're building Cross River Rail, and we made the decision to build Cross River Rail long before we were successful in our bid for the Olympics. And because, frankly, there is nothing but population growth ahead of us here in Brisbane. We're expecting anywhere between 1.5 to 2 million people to move here out over the next 15 to 20 years. We're looking at a future where there'll be more reasons for more people to travel to, from, and through Brisbane more often. And we have a phrase we use, which is roads alone will not cope. So you can build an extra lane on the on all the freeways and highways every year for the next 20 years, and you're probably still going to have car congestion. You absolutely need to put in place the things that you need to move people around by public transport, not just rail, but bus. And we have a ferry network that goes up and down our river. For example, you need more bike paths, you need walkable connections, and we need river crossings. So there's a whole bunch of stuff to do there. It's really all about priming the system for a more wholesale shift away from the car and onto public transport.
So going back to what you said earlier about getting started, what was the first priority for the project that you had to sell the vision for to get the city to agree? How did you get this rolling?
As I mentioned before, the project, like a lot of these mega projects in any cities, had been talked about a lot and debated a lot and had been planned and replanned, but no one had actually committed to funding. The state government in 2017, look, it's time to grasp this nettle, as it were, and move to starting delivery proper. So they announced that Cross River Rail would be funded $5.4 billion Australian dollars out over forward estimates. And that was the starting gun that got us moving. Funding is the first priority. But the other thing we realized and we learned quite quickly, you have to make people understand there's a problem before they can necessarily appreciate that you're going to spend all that money building a solution. So all the people who just drive to and from Brisbane every day and don't use rail a lot wouldn't necessarily know that the rail network is constrained by a bottleneck in the middle. And if they don't know, they don't necessarily care. And if they don't care, then they don't necessarily agree that the government should be diverting significant amounts of taxpayers' money into the investment. So one of the things I learned pretty quick was make people understand what the problem is before you can get them to appreciate the solution.
And you say that like it was easy, but I'm sure it wasn't. So what strategies and approaches did you use to get them to appreciate the problem that the rail system had?
When I started on the project as the comms guy, I inherited a one-off research study into the project's social license. So I don't know if you're aware of social license models. I certainly wasn't when I started, but I know a lot about them now. But essentially, social license is the premise that large infrastructure projects quite often at the beginning have what's called level zero. So level zero is that people are either unaware of the infrastructure or aware but oppose it. And that's exactly where the research said that this project sat. It said that it was that thing that politicians had talked a lot about, but probably wasn't getting built. And even if they did build it, they'd probably get it wrong. So there's a lot of negativity around it. The social license model talks about how you need to move as you move from contract award to start of construction to finishing construction to testing and to opening your infrastructure, which can take, in our case, as much as 8 or 9 years. You need to move the public through stages of awareness, understanding, not only understanding, but possibly advocacy. So not only do I know what the infrastructure is, but I believe it's going to benefit me personally, to a point of ultimately co-ownership, where not only do I understand what the infrastructure is, not only do I know how it works, not only do I believe it will benefit me, but I'm willing to tell others they should believe in it too. And I'm very proud of it. And you don't really get to that co-ownership until you've built it and it works. So this model shows you a journey that you're going to need to walk the public through. It allows you to consider what channels you're going to use to communicate with the public in and what messages are going to work hardest for you.
The new subway line in London, the Elizabeth line that a lot of you are probably familiar with, it was similarly massive. 60 miles of new subway, building new stations, refurbishing dozens of existing, 250 million passengers every year. It took decades to complete. You went to them for lessons learned as you've embarked on your efforts. What was the biggest lesson or takeaway they taught you?
we were very lucky in that what is now called the Elizabeth Line, when it was being built, the project was referred to as Crossrail, and obviously we are Cross River Rail. They were a new underground line going east-west across London. We're a new underground line going north-south under Brisbane. I think they put 10 new underground stations into the middle of London, which is phenomenally complex, as you can imagine. We were putting 4 new underground stations under the city of Brisbane. So lots of parallels. And we happened to be going into delivery, just as they thought at the time, back in 2018, they were nearing the end of delivery. Now, it turns out for them, unfortunately, they didn't quite get to the end. They experienced some problems and the project didn't open for a few years after that. But they, some of their key people were already willing to share projects that were coming after them, some key learnings. And one of those key people was a guy called Malcolm from the UK, who I have since met and I am now pleased to say I'm great friends with. And Malcolm was head of information systems on Crossrail. And he came out to Australia on a bit of a speaking tour. And he talked very eloquently about how if they had their time again, they would have handled information differently, and in particular 3D digital information. So they talked about how obviously nowadays, whenever infrastructure is built, at the core of that build process are BIM models, building information models. And that enables you to see future outcomes, the things you haven't built yet in 3D, recreated in digital 3D. But Malcolm explained that they didn't realize until too far into their construction process that they could have, should have, would have built a single bigger, better 3D model of their project. And he broke that down for us and said that different contractors were giving them different types of information in different formats, so that they struggled to ever have a single, what's called a federated BIM model of their entire project. They had lots of separate BIM models of different bits that different contractors were building for them. And he talked very eloquently about how they had a what's called a GIS, or a geospatial information system, like web map, like a 2D digital map, like a Google map bespoke to their project, if you think of it like that. But it was separate from the BIM endeavors. And so they had these two kind of cool digital visualization tools, but they weren't, they were separate to each other. And he observed that he thought moving forward, the smart thing to do would be to find ways to combine those two data sets into what's called a common data environment. So it all sounds very techie, but if you think about it, it's basically just saying a bunch of people over here doing building information modeling, bit disjointed. Bunch of people over here doing 2D web mapping, looking at things like geographic cadastres and stuff like that. Brilliant, but disconnected. If I had my time again, I'd fix all that and I'd put it all into a single common data environment. And yeah, we were very lucky in that we were able to go, we're at the start. That sounds great. We'll go away and do those things. And that's exactly what we did. And it's paid us back tenfold.
So you have the 3D digital model, you built it in a consolidated way, but the British team also had recommended that you use a new piece of technology, Unreal Engine. Can you tell us a little more about that and how that was used and fit in?
Absolutely. Yeah, this was definitely an interesting moment, having to take this piece of advice back to the CEO. And I distinctly remember saying to Malcolm, like, a gaming engine, you mean like the thing we built computer games in? And he was like, yep. And I was like, okay, so why would we do that? And he said, and he was right, he said, it will give you back a virtual version of what you haven't built yet. It will give you back a photoreal, interactive, immersive, virtual reality of the thing you're about to start building that you can spawn people into first person at scale as a virtual reality. And people who develop games are driven by making experiences simple and easy for users to use. So if you apply that to complicated geotechnical and BIM data sets, suddenly a huge opportunity appears before you. And that was pretty it. And he was bang on the money. So we did that as well.
Yeah, you'd say gaming engine, and people think it's a video game, it's a toy, but really it's an emerging technology that allowed your constituents, the public, to see the extent of this build before anything had even started.
That's exactly right. So it sounds flippant now, but at the time it was quite a concern for myself and people on the project, which is So you've just announced to the public that you're going to spend billions and billions of dollars on this critical piece of infrastructure. The only problem is it doesn't exist yet, so people can't necessarily see it. They can only imagine it. And even when it does exist, it's an underground line, so they still can't see it, and they still have to imagine it. Suddenly realizing that what we were going to get back was an ability for people to walk around the train stations, to fly along at 2,000 feet, the rail alignment, to see or even be in it as a future outcome, became very powerful for building that social license and for getting that original understanding and awareness and that shift to not just awareness, but approval and advocacy. It became a very powerful tool for us. But it also isn't just about the public. Right from the get-go, this was about realizing that we could use it to track and aid and optimize the design process. So again, big mega projects, you don't design it once and then just go, that's what we're building. The design process evolves out over several years, and you're still finishing and finalizing design way into the point at which you've started construction. So it was a really important tool for that. And then now that we are nearing the end of major construction and we're going into the last couple of years, which will be made up mostly of testing and commissioning and familiarization and getting ready to hand infrastructure over to the rail operators, we now use this ability, this virtual reality, we use it for really lots of internal purposes where we work with the rail operator and use it to show train drivers and train guards exactly what the experience is going to be like when these trains are running in and out of these new stations and these new tunnels. It's actually a very hardworking tool on a day-to-day basis, and it helps us arrive at, we've unearthed this concept of a preliminary approval based on a digital visualization is very powerful, because when you go back to get your final approval based on the actual built outcome, you can remind people that they gave you the preliminary approval. And if the digital visualization matches the final built outcome, they're less likely to say they've got a problem. And if they haven't got a problem, you're less likely to experience delays or issues handing the built project back over to your rail operator.
So if I summarize, you built a 3D digital model to assist with the design construction phase, but what you've seen is it's actually expanded use all the way through the operational phase, and you're finding new use cases as you progress through the process.
100%. And because of that BIM data, it's technically accurate down to 2 millimeters. So if you take an engineer who is normally a bit suspicious of fancy 3D digital visuals, and you show them an environment that is photoreal and 2 millimeter accurate to BIM data, they change their mind and they start to believe. What we're learning now is this is a huge opportunity for this kind of digital environment to aid and smooth the very tricky business of a delivery authority handing something it's built over to a rail operator that didn't build it.
So you said this digital twin earlier would be left behind for those operating the rail system, but I also have read you refer to it as going from 3D to 7D. Most people have no idea what 7D is. And to be honest, I don't really know what 7D is. So can you explain that and help us understand how it works?
People pretty much accept that we don't build buildings, or in our case, underground stations or railway lines, off 2D architectural drawings anymore. We build them using three-dimensional BIM models, okay? So people can get that. They can get that it's a three-dimensional digital version of what used to be a two-dimensional architect's drawing. 4D is when you take that 3D digital model and you show that a building is going to go from this stage to complete, okay? So you basically just show the stages of build as they're going to progress. And a little counter in the corner says that's going to take 1 month, 2 months, 4 months, 8 months. And that's time. So all 4D is you're just modeling time versus a 3D structure. Imagine you've got another little counter in the corner. And as that time progresses from 1 month to 2 months to 8 months to 12 months or whatever, a dollar figure goes up and it goes 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million. And it just shows the cost of the build and how the cost of the build is going to occur in line with the time of the build. That's 5D. So you're modeling. So 4D and 5D are really just modeling time and money. Okay. Now, 6D and this is the one where people, professionals in this space, get very excited, is when you go, hang on a second, if I've got a technically accurate photo reel virtual 3D model of a building that I haven't built yet, can I use that model to forward think and optimize how the building will operate? Can I use it to run future scenarios? Can I use it to contemplate energy load or sustainability or building efficiency? And the answer is yes, of course you can. So that's your 6D. That is when you're using six-dimensional thinking, is when you're using your digital model to future plan how infrastructure is going to operate. And then 7D, which is the holy grail, is where you go, hang on a second, if I've got a photoreal, technically accurate digital twin of a piece of infrastructure that now exists in the real world, can I use that 7D model to run that infrastructure in real time? And my favorite example of this is probably Singapore. So people talk about virtual Singapore and hold virtual Singapore up as an exemplar of a digital twin or a smart city. And they write to, in Singapore, they use virtual, where it rains in real Singapore, it rains in virtual Singapore. They use virtual Singapore to monitor what's happening in the city in real time and to contemplate how the digital version of the city can tell the real version of the city how to operate. So they use all sorts of sensors and technology to watch what's going on and to run scenarios. And then they use their digital twin to operate their city in real time. And that's 7D thinking.
What do you see as next for Brisbane?
Turns out if you're building a 3D digital model or a 7D digital model of a railway infrastructure that goes under a city, you're going to have to model the city that it's going under as well as the built environment on top, which means that you actually end up contemplating at each of your underground stations, how does the road network knit in? How does it connect into existing walkways, roadways, nearby buildings and the such like? Which means actually that you spend a lot of time just contemplating how does the city work per se. So there's huge opportunities with projects like this that have built models like this to actually start to use them to contemplate as a minimum transport. So roadways, bus systems, ferry systems, walkways, pathways, pedestrian cycleways, and to do exactly what you did with your rail network, really, which is look at what you've currently got, put into the model what you might build yet, and then contemplate, optimize, optioneer, refine what's going to work hardest for you. So it helps. I think these models are a huge opportunity to plan better outcomes faster. And that basically saves money.
What advice would you give others like London gave to you trying to do something on even perhaps a smaller scale? What would be your few pieces of advice?
It turns out that when you're doing 3D digital visual and you're exploring and you're pioneering in that space over an 8-year, 9-year cycle, you're banking on technology that's still evolving and you don't know how that technology is going to evolve. You're going to need some left brain and right brain thinking. I get to do these interviews and I get to present on what we've done, and I'm very proud of it and I've certainly been involved in it, but I am not the only person involved. I was put together by our very clever CEO in the early days. He realized that what he needed to do was he needed a bit of left brain and he needed a bit of right brain if we were going to have some vision in this space. He put me together with our program controls director, who is a guy called Peter Quick, who is a man who thinks in Excel and spreadsheets. He put us together, and he knew that by putting us together, we'd essentially do something a bit more ambitious between us than we might have done individually. You need vision, but you need some real world practical thinking too.
This has been just such a great conversation, so interesting, and maybe inadvertently you've convinced me that I need to go to Brisbane for the Olympics in a few years. I will look you up and we'll get a chance to ride the rail together.
Thanks for the chance to chat this through. Always happy to talk about this stuff.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.